Okay, well, let's get back to work in a way. I just had a lot of small conversations, little short time there. Each one of them was sterling, and I wish we could all sit down and kind of move from table to table and talk about things and talk through things, because all of this stuff, this is nothing that I'm saying is something I've brought to the table or anything new. I mean, it is this stuff that's in us. It is our life, and I think what Merton is so amazingly gifted in, even without him knowing it, was how he, when he just opened his life, almost everybody in the world could find some kind of connection or hit a responsive chord. That as he was opening up his life, he was opening up life itself. And people could see their life, even though they weren't male, or they weren't monk, or they weren't Catholic, or they weren't born in 1915, or whatever the particulars would be. It was and so we were just talking about him grumbling about some things. He would write, if you read his journals, they're so different than his letters to people, which are so different than his formal essays, and then the books that he wrote just on purpose as a book. A lot of his books are just short essays that he would write and stay on a theme and then move on to something else. In his journals, though, you find him grumbling, complaining about this, you know, the brothers that can't keep a tune in choir and it drives them crazy and stuff like that. And then he tells a lot of jokes and stories about things, the tricks that people would play on each other. And in his day, they used sign language. You couldn't actually talk in the monastery. They did not take a vow of silence, but it was the silent life. And so, but they created their own sign language of jokes and puns and ridicule and, you know, gentle mockery. And he had a lot of fun. An abbot later in the 70s, Timothy Kelly, when he came into Gethsemane, he had read Merton and was inspired by him and wanted to be a Cistercian monk. But when he got there, he couldn't find Merton because he didn't know where Merton was. Merton was not known as Thomas Merton. He was known as Father Lewis. And so the monks who went to Gethsemane because they read Thomas Merton couldn't find Thomas Merton. And when they went, they thought he was going to be a certain way, you know, like this or... or something, but this Thomas Merton had a blue jean jacket on, and he was clumsy. He had a devilish grin. He was laughing. He had a deep voice. Listen to his conferences. He was just a real person. And they didn't know that this clown or this goofball or this guy who was kind of blasting down the hall was this incredible saintly intellectual that they had read. So one day Timothy Kelly was speaking to Merton, who was kind of his superior, obviously, and he was explaining himself to Merton, and Merton said, and Kelly said, I've read some books by Thomas Merton, and I've read some by this other guy who was an older monk, and he says, well, what do you think about those book by Merton? He said, well, they're not quite as good as these other books. And and Merton didn't let on. So Timothy Kelly later became an abbot, was always fond of that story that Merton, he didn't take himself seriously. So the fact that you came in, you didn't know who he was perfectly fine with that. A psychologist in the 50s, though, told Merton that he had such an ego, he wanted to be the monk in Times Square. This just hit Merton to the core. I mean, it almost cracked him up. He almost had a breakdown. I'll tell you a little bit about that maybe after lunch, but we'll work our way up to that. As somebody who leads a quiet life and then becomes famous, you have to appreciate what this must do to somebody. You're a monk, you're not supposed to talk, and yet you're writing. You're hidden from the world, you're detached. Everybody knows who you are. Everybody was always inviting him to come out and go join a Nicaraguan poet who once was a monk at Gethsemane, Ernesto Cardenal, wanted Merton to come to Nicaragua and join their poetic monastery. Cardenal would later be part of the Sandinistas in the Nicaraguan Revolution. Merton, they wouldn't let Merton go. He thought about it. But let me, we'll get back to Merton's biography in this white page in just a second. Let me, back to Thoughts in Solitude. This is my old copy of it. We don't have, it's in the first book, and it's probably chapter 3, but he says, spiritual life is not mental life. Something about, and this is just a crucial kind of principle for Merton. And he had to learn this. I'll come back to that story. He had to learn that the spiritual life is not the mental life. He grew up very mental. He was an intellectual. And some monks kind of, he rubbed them the wrong way because he was intellectual. He was a poet. He knew language. He spoke in big words. Sometimes maybe talked over them or something. But for Merton, the spiritual life was not mental. It wasn't intellectual in the Western, modern kind of sense. And so there's an activity that's proper to us as human beings that he's talking about in this chapter. And he says, our destiny is to live out what we think, because unless we live what we know, we do not even know it. Remember the line a little earlier, we need to know what we're doing. We need to pay attention. Part of that work is our thoughts. Part of it is dealing with our thoughts. Well, part of centering prayer is realizing these thoughts come and go, and they're kind of fleeting, but we're kind of centering in something that's deeper than the thoughts. But Merton was real, and your thoughts get in the way. So here's a monk who's famous. How does he think about that? How does he think through that? How does he get through his own thinking? How does he pierce and penetrate his own writing so that it doesn't become cliches, which he hated to death? By going a little bit more, if a man is to live, now this is a 50, still using male pronouns. If man is to live, he must be all alive. Body, soul, mind, heart, spirit. Everything must be elevated and transformed by the action of God in love and faith. If you've read Merton, if you take anything away from this day, please take that Merton was this whole person. And this whole person had wanted to embrace reality, the whole of it. He was not stupid enough to think that he could actually get his arms around the whole thing. If it's the whole, you cannot possess it. You can't commandeer it. You can't get on top of it. You can't be in charge, and you cannot control your own life, because your life is in God, and you cannot control God. But you've got to be alive to this. And this is just a thrust of his own life, pushing through his own monastic vocation and his vocation as a writing. So living for Merton, still in this little chapter early in the Thoughts in Solitude, living is the constant adjustment of thought to life and life to thought in such a way that we are always growing, always experiencing new things in the old and old things in the new. Thus, life is always new. Modern people think that way and think they're on the cutting edge of life by doing the new thing, getting an upgrade to the computer, getting the next size of larger Pepsi at Wendy's. We're getting the new and improved Tide to wash our clothes. We're familiar. That's commotion. That's just running around doing the new thing, getting the new car, getting the new wife, a new set of kids. I heard some guy in a bookstore one time talk about his new set of kids. It's like, where do you pick these up? Sears? Is that where you go get a new set of kids, like a set of tires? I was floored by hearing that. But that's how some people live, and that's their sense of new life. For Merton, and we picked this up in this first session, life just keeps blowing. It just keeps blowing. That's what's new. It's perennial. It's persistent. It just goes through everything. And you get a hold of that, but not in the way that you possess it, but in the way you stay close to it. That's being attentive. But we got to go through something. So I'm going to come back to Merton's life. We'll pick up after he gets in the monastery. Let's do that now, and then we'll read this thought about breaking through. So we're on that white sheet, official page number 8, The Contemplative Journey of Merton, in part 2, Monastic Years, Illumination. His life kind of falls sort of like Dante's Inferno and the Paradiso, and then the Purgatory in the middle. When he wrote his best-selling autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain, that was taken from Dante. The seven-story mountain was purgatory, the seven levels of purgatory, and you've got to go through all these sins. Well, Merton felt like he had all of those sins, and he had to go through all of those sins to get to the top. And when in Dante, when you get to the top of Mount Purgatorio, then you look up and you see paradise. And that's when the circle of angels is around in the visual terms of Dante. Well, he has read, because he's an English major, and he's a poet. He's already read Dante. And so that when he becomes a monk and he writes his autobiography, at the command of his abbot, who told him, write your life story. I think people would like to know how you got here. He does it. We'll come to that in just a second. 42, let's start there, though. He's entered the monastery, December 1941. So 1942, he breaks from his own journal writing, doing his own writing, writing his own poetry. He had a novel he wanted to finish. But he's become a monk. And he abandons writing. He says, I've given up my literary career, my future. I'm not going to write. I'm going to be a monk. I'll do whatever they tell me. This is his head when he goes in. So he's received into the novitiate on the 21st. They give him the name Father Lewis. The next year, his brother John Paul is reported missing in action. John Paul went to university in the States, but then he joined the Royal Air Force of Canada during World War II, and he was shot down over the Atlantic. And Merton wrote a beautiful poem. I did not bring it, but if you read some of his collected poems or some of the other editions, For My Brother is the name of it. And the gist of the poem is, I would gladly give my life for you. You died. I just as soon take your place and let you live this life as a monk. That was his last relative, you know, his last close. It's a moving poem. It's one page, but it's a striking poem. He didn't have that. He was very close to his brother, but they didn't have a whole lot shared because they lived so separately. But he's in the monastery, and then he receives word that his brother, the last one in his family, has now died. And so Merton is really kind of all alone in this strange place in just 1 year. And he's only 28, you know. He takes simple vows. He writes some poems. He takes solemn vows, and these are the, sort of the order of vows in 3 years' time when you enter a monastery before you become a monk. It can take a little later. 1948 is when he publishes his autobiography. There's a lot that's happened between 42 and 48, so I'm just putting down some basics here. What you can should know and appreciate if you don't already is that when you become a monk, you're assigned work tasks. You pray most of the day and you work most of the day. Work, prayer, is the sort of the slogan or the motto of the Cistercians, work, prayer, and study. So they have a library, they have books. So you pray, you liturgy of the hours, you go, that's what they mean by going to choir, chanting the Psalms. You study, you read classic works of spirituality. Then you do work, which is the work of the maintenance of the monastery and whatever the trade is that earns the income to keep the place going. One of Merton's jobs was to plant trees, and they said that he planted thousands of trees and they all died. He planted the wrong kind of trees for the ecology of the region, but he thought they'd be nice trees. Later he wanted to be, he really wanted a hermitage. So he's in a monastery and he wants more quiet. Well, Cistercians at that time did not have hermits. They didn't. That was not in their tradition. It was a communal order. Well, Merton kept pushing and pushing and pushing. Finally, his abbot let him. When the abbot stepped down and retired, he became a hermit. But for the longest time, he fought Merton on this. But one of the pseudo-hermitages Merton was given was a fire tower. And he was given the job of being the forest fire watcher. And this was in the days when the Park Service would love anybody in any part of a state to keep a watch of fires, especially in the South at the time. We still had a whole lot of forests. So he loved nature. He loved trees. He loved deer. He loved birds, snakes. He was a very nature guy, but he was not mechanical. So that when they gave him jobs that were mechanical, he struggled. He could not drive to save his life. They didn't let him drive after a while, especially after one incident where he rode this Jeep and he was all off the road half the time. When he died of electrocution after a shower. He was on a terrazzo floor. His feet are wet. And he turned on an electric fan, you know, the old kind, standing, tall electric fan. It had faulty wiring. When he turned it on, it electrocuted, and he fell down, and the fan fell down on him. Well, now, this is how he died, but this relates to the story in the 40s and 50s. Father Matthew, one of the brothers and one of the brothers under him, said when Merton died, a few days later, he said, well, that, it figures he would die that way. He was such a clumsy person. Now, this was not sacrilegious or disrespectful. I mean, he loved this man. He cried like a baby. But the there's a sense of humor in a monastic house, and you probably have house to house it changes. But in a monastic house, there's a sense of humor, such as when you're walking in a cemetery, and I heard a woman one time say, oh, I hate to walk in the cemetery over these people, that these poor souls that died, and the monk that was walking with her, there's nobody down there. So they have a kind of monastic humor that can strike you as very sarcastic. But they're really not thinking in a material kind of way the way we are thinking, so that it's not they're being irreverent. Or the Father Matthew was when he commented on, well, it seemed like he would probably, if he's going to die, it's probably going to be some kind of mechanical mishap because he was so clumsy. That was his way of kind of paying tribute. Kind of, you remember Don Rickles and his comic routines? That's kind of the way Father Matthew was. It was his way of paying respect. So what became Merton's primary task was writing. The abbot that was in charge when he got there, not Dom Fox, who most of us are somewhat familiar with, if you're familiar with Merton's story, but the earlier abbot, whose name escapes me at the moment, saw in Merton a gift of writing, and he said, why don't you write your autobiography, and why don't you also as a job, because you know language, he'd studied a bunch of languages. He spoke maybe 12 languages and wrote in maybe 15 languages, can read in them, so he was multilingual. And a part of his love of language just kind of just filtered on, and he just kept learning. He was learning Japanese when he died. He was learning Russian when he was, and because he wanted to correspond with anybody who was from Japan or anybody who was from Russia. He wanted to communicate because he was wide open. So he was given the task of writing, and one of the first little jobs he was given was read the old French text of our order and translate them into modern English so our brothers who don't read French could read where we came from. And then he started translating other, what would we call the mystics. And he started reading all of these contemplatives, which we call contemplative now, but they weren't necessarily calling them that in the 40s. And he started to discover what the tradition was all about. He came into the monastery thinking it was one way, and he had not heard about contemplation. And then he started learning. It was awakening by force of vocation and work. What is this all about? And he really thought through it. So when he read these works and he would translate them, put them in words, he put them in his words and in words of the 1940s and 50s for his brothers to be able to understand. He wrote in-house documents with it, not his name on it. And it was just what these other people said as he would try to explain. So what they gave him the task of sort of rediscovering the tradition of the order, which sent him back all the way back to the beginning. And, you know, before Vatican II, there was a lot of push to get back to the sources, get back to the beginning. Where did the church go wrong? Where do we need to get back to? What's the foundation of for things? Of course, he would track this all the way back to God, and this is what would become of contemplation. There's a little handout here. Don't turn to it, but there's a handout about the books that Merton wrote specifically about contemplation. It started early. He's starting to think about what is this that we do as spiritual beings. We contemplate. What is contemplation? Who wrote about this? Who knows about this? He goes back in the tradition and he finds all these people writing about contemplative prayer, contemplative life. Then he starts opening up to people in all kinds of countries and other traditions, other cultures. They're contemplating. They're contemplating. Buddhists in Asian cultures will use the word meditation for what we use is contemplation. But as Christians, we also have meditation, but it's usually a more wordy kind of thing. But it could be a thought type of meditation. We can use these words interchangeably and kind of as opposed to each other. But Merton started to keep he was just tracking contemplation. And what is it he's doing when he's contemplating? What do other people do when they're contemplating? Who is contemplating? Please tell me so I can go talk to them and find out how they're doing this. Kind of relates to the question a little earlier. How do you contemplate? There doesn't seem to be this one way to do it. It's just whatever you need to do to get there. And you're contemplating the depth. So not to be facetious, but let's say the ocean is deep. Then we know it is. We haven't been to the bottom of it still after all these centuries. We don't know. There's still species way down there. We don't know what they are. We just assume they are because we're not down there and we can't see them. But there's all kinds of ways to get into the ocean. I mean, you can be dropped out of a plane. You can take a little boat out, a little excursion, and hop over with some flippers and your own fins and a mask. You can start on the beach and just start walking out. There's all kinds of ways to get into that ocean, but that's the depth. If you're looking for the depth, you're contemplating, and the depth is reality. And if reality is in existence because of God's life, you're contemplating God's life, and you're trying to get to the depth of God's life. And it's all completely in you. It's not limited to you. But we're bubbling over with it. We're going down inside ourselves into the interior. That's our means. That's our method. That's how we tap into the life in which we are in. So you think of that plumb line. We got to go through something to get down there, but we're dropping in. The Orthodox Christians have, if you've ever read the Philokalia, is anybody familiar with that? 4-volume set in English? Well, it's hard to get now because it's kind of out of print. Volume 1 is still around. So you get a hold of this. This is the other side of the Catholic Church. 1,000 years we were all together. Well, in the late 1700s, some Orthodox Christians compiled from the 4th to the 16th century, I think, all the texts on contemplation, all the texts on interior prayer, interior life. We've got 4 volumes in English. The 5th volume is pending. The last writer, translator, is head of the Orthodox Church in England, Calistos Ware. It's a beautiful series of books. All these monks, some of them you've heard, Evagrius, if you know about Desert Wisdom and those monks. So it's our Greek contemplative tradition all put together in the late 1790s or early 1790s. Well, they have this phrase they're the ones who teach the Jesus Prayer, which is very similar to a centering prayer where you just say, basically, Lord, have mercy, I'm a sinner. It's like embracing reality. It's facing yourself. It's admitting. No pretense. Something about clearing ourselves, no pretense, going down, being quiet. That becomes like a kind of mantra when you say that prayer and over, or you just say the word Jesus, and then like we were saying love earlier, and then you just sort of melt into this depth. Well, they have another phrase. I just think this is absolutely beautiful. It's a little more of the 19th century Orthodox monks who would teach this. And they would teach, let the mind drop into the heart. Now, if you think of that plumb again, that plumb line, at the top is the mind. The mind's got to go down through that commotion. And it's got to go all the way down into the heart. It drops into it like it's like a rock into the ocean. It is a... to me, it's one of the most beautiful phrasings or descriptions of prayer. But you got to go all the way down, which we're going to come to. We're going to come to the Merton's poem. You got to go all the way down. You got to go all the way through something and get down there. I mean, that's like in the into the depths of what undergirds us, our very life. This is what Merton is doing. He rediscovers the monastic tradition, the Christian Catholic tradition. He discovers the Orthodox Church, all because he's translating other works, and then he starts to write his own. As his own life starts to force him into speaking for himself, and then the abbot says, go ahead, write your stuff. Not many people were really publishing as monks. It just wasn't one of the jobs, but it became Merton's task. But here's the most amazing thing. We're going to read something, if you want to start turning to the blue page. A monk's life is very regulated, so he wrote a ton of things. But he only had a couple hours a day to do it. This included all the correspondence. And there's like five volumes, it'd be a stack this high of letters. And they've still got 13 to 16,000 letters they haven't published. But all these letters that he wrote to everybody, Jackie Onassis, Boris Pasternak, he wrote everybody. And they wrote back. They were glad to hear from him. But he does all this writing in a small span of time each day. He writes, and then he does some other things. Sometimes he would cook. Sometimes he'd go plant some trees, drive the Jeep, watch out for fire, do some other kinds of things. But he didn't write all day long. He didn't have a privileged writing lifestyle. Not till the end, when he was given clearance to be a hermit for a while. He still had to come back to the house and pray with the brothers, attend church. He was still part of the community. But he was given a little bit extra time, and he kind of needed that. But for the longest period, 20 years, he only had a little window of time to write. And then this amazing outpouring of words came from him. It was like a flood out of his soul. The whole time he's uncovering this tradition, he's uncovering his own soul. And this flood, almost like an ocean, starts to pulse through him. And this is the work of breaking through. Let's look at what he says about this. I'm on the blue sheet, Conference 2, Breakthrough. These are words from Thoughts in Solitude again. All good meditative prayer is a conversion of our entire self to God. Let me just stop there for a second. If you can sense what I was saying as I'm trying to present what he's kind of going through a tumultuous period of writing and an unearthing. And he has experienced a total conversion of himself. Not just, oh, so this is what you guys do here. I'm kind of new to the monastery. In fact, I'm new to Catholicism and religious life. But now I'm in it. I thought it was like this. And it turns out he's not learning it from the place. He's not being taught this. He's not in formation getting this. He's learning it through his own existence as he is tackling and embracing the order and the things that people weren't reading because they couldn't read those things. And he's putting together thought and life, life and thought. He's being converted, continually converted and opened. One cannot enter into meditation in this sense, in this entire conversion sense, without a kind of inner upheaval. By upheaval, I do not mean a disturbance, but a breaking out of routine, a liberation of the heart from the cares and preoccupations of one's daily business. The reason why so few people apply themselves seriously to mental prayer, quiet prayer, silent prayer, is precisely that this inner upheaval is necessary, and they are usually incapable of the effort required to make it. It may be that they lack generosity. It may also be that they lack direction and experience and go about it in the wrong way. They disturb themselves. They throw themselves into agitation by the violent efforts they make to get recollected. And finally, they end in hopelessness. They compromise in the end by a series of frustrated routines which help them to pass the time, or else they relax into a state of semi-coma of contemplation. But there's not many contemplatives that write about that. I mean, you have to know this. You have to experience how you faked yourself out. And it was easy for Merton he's not a monk. So now I'm with these monks, and so I'm doing the monk thing, and it's not necessarily working out. Well, what should I be doing? What's the real thing? He starts to experience the real thing, and it just blows apart the structures, which are not bad, but the thing is not in those structures. It's in that wind blowing through that open room. It would be the death of him to compromise with reality and go for something short. And so he's claiming here, he's not being hard on us or on the world that we live in, if you read the rest of the context here. He realizes this is hard for people. In fact, this is almost impossible for people to break through the upheaval or to experience the upheaval, because we tend to maintain control of our life. Well, you have to laugh at yourself. I mean, you can't do it. You can't control your... I'm starting to feel reckless. I'm going to just say some things. I'm going to blurt it out. You can't control your life. You can't control your kids. You can't control America. You can't control Obama. You can't control health care. You can't control this. You cannot control me at this point because I'm losing it. You have no power to do it. But this is what we do almost 99.5% of the day is we determine our life. We make our plans. We set our schedule. Well, how else can you live? We don't know because that's all we know to do. Plan our day. Plan our mate. Well, I'm going to have 3 kids. I remember a woman in college who she was student body president. It was a 22,000 student university. And she said she declared by a 2-year window what year she would marry. The man would have a 6-figure salary. She was going to be a lawyer. She wouldn't even date someone who was not already in the pipeline for the 6-year salary. And when she said these things, she had her life mapped out. Well, I'm thinking, well, this is not going to work out for you. But the class jumped on her. They were so upset. They were so upset at her kind of cockiness that she could dare think that she could actually determine who's going to be in her life and on what kinds of grounds. They were horrified by the almost antiseptic, almost scientific, methodical, systematic, corporate accounting kind of way that she had laid down her life, and she was like, this was defining how my life is going to be, and it will be this way. That's almost like a godlike complex. And they were just kind of horrified. I had to settle them down. I mean, if they hadn't jumped on her, I might have jumped on her. But but you can't do it. And you already know you can't do it. And every day we proved ourselves we don't do it. Well, how do we pay attention to that? And how do we learn anything from that? And what do you do when you don't control life? We're really not that practiced in not controlling our life. And then if our spiritual life is something separate from our life, we're really in trouble. Because then we got our life over here, and then, well, I got my spiritual life thing over here. I'm controlling that. I do this on certain kinds of ways. Now, we know we can even make fun of people that we see doing this in an amateurish way. But us that are pros, pros go to centering prayer. Pros go to daily mass. Pros have read all this. Pros know all this. Professional people that we are in controlling things. We're constantly having to find some way to be renewed. It's being broken out of the routine in which we control our life, which means we're not contemplating. We're not, in my terms, we're not receiving that life. We're not open to it. And this is what's just burning through Merton. He has to be open to this. If it's not God, he doesn't want anything else but God. And if I'm making this up, I don't want any of this stuff. This would just be pure crap. Unless there's truth, unless there's a reality here. Somehow we do sense that. And so we're back to like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. How do you follow this? So that's the life of faith. You're looking for light. You're not the light. You don't direct the light. It is shown to you. And you don't have very far to go. If we want to go into the deep, this is the interior of our life. It's the life of our life. We can't control that. What does Christ say? If you're looking for this, you'll find it. If you're not looking for it, you're not going to find it. And if you're looking for it, are you really looking for it? Or are you looking for some version? The 2015 Silent Life or something. If you would like to have this life, Christ said, well, ask. And if you get there, once you get to the ocean and you get down to the bottom of the ocean and you face that door, knock on the door. But we won't knock on the door. We don't ask. We say, well, I know. Or we seek in all the wrong places. We know all that. We have our answers to our questions. Can we break through all of that? It's almost like a skit that we're involved in. It's almost like we're writing it up. And then sometimes we do a little tragic ending of that chapter, and we do a little comic reading here, and we interpret our life. Our very thinking is a kind of controlling mechanism that we, and it just makes us kind of unsettled to how do you give up all of that? How do you get through that? Now, it's a great question, and if you had a good speaker here, they probably could... if you had a good speaker, they're not going to be able to tell you. Nobody knows this. You can't know this. But remember what Jesus says when he says, look at that flower? I was bowled over yesterday when I came up through the walkway and saw those red geraniums. Now, we have red geraniums in Memphis, but we only have them spring through fall. We don't have them in the winter months. And it's really my favorite flower. The boldness of that red and the darkness of that green leaf, the hardiness of the plant, I just find that plant, personally, I just find it very beautiful. So when I saw that, I was just ecstatic coming in. Well, it may not have been a red geranium that Christ was talking about when he said, look at the lilies of the field, but they don't toil or spin. They're not controlling anything. They're just, to Merton, and he referred to those flowers in the field, they're just praising God, being who they are. For us as people, we're trying to be something. We're trying to do something. We're trying to get something, have something, make something out of ourselves. That's not what God has asked us to do or to be ourselves. Well, if I go be myself, I'm not all this. I'm not all this great. Well, that's our interpretation. We don't even know who we are. Only way we can know, at least our tradition tells us, is we have to actually shut up. And I hate to say this as a speaker, but it is the truth. And we have to go into silence. And that's because you hear something. You are given something. As long as we're running our mouths, as speakers do, nothing can get in. But when you close down, when you shut down, when you decide to go ahead and give up the shop and the show and all the work, something opens up, something shows it to you. This is what Merton was just so excited about. So he calls it here breaking out of a routine, and he calls it a liberation of the heart from the cares and preoccupations of one's daily business. These cares, we're so familiar with these, the burdens. This is why we pray every day. And we're trying to loosen ourselves of these things. We're trying to let God help us. As long as we're trying to help, I mean, we're almost like God, we want God in control. That's almost a thought to me that's like we're still wanting, somebody's got to control something. Merton, I just don't think he had this sense that God was a controller. Or that we're to be in God, and then we would be in. We'd be controlled by the great controller. His sense of life and reality was not even about control. It was about life itself. But that can be kind of, you got to watch this and you got to test this out. You don't just certainly accept this kind of stuff. It's not nice talk. It's kind of hard. But this is kind of how Merton talked. Everything that I'm saying is just kind of. I've been reading Merton for years, and this is what it seems to me he's trying to say. Let me stop for a minute on this last point about the semi-coma and check the time, see how we're doing on time. What time do we? How much further we go to break? How much time do we have for some? 12:15. Okay, good. Give me a couple more minutes, and then let's talk a little bit. A semi-coma. If you watch films these days, every film seems like is filled with zombies. There's zombies everywhere. And one of the reasons is, and film scholars have been looking at this, where psychologists are looking at this, it's a concern about dehumanization. We are really literally worried what is happening in Europe, what is happening in this country, all of our social institutions, everything seems to be falling apart. We're moving around. It's like everything has exploded. You can't count on anything, but everybody's busy counting everything, but you can't count on anybody. You don't know what's going to happen. It seemed like it would be fertile ground for faith, but it just kind of scares us to death because everything that's structured, nailed down, seems to be completely loose. And what can you count on? It is a golden moment for a contemplative. But it's a scary kind of thing. If something is happening to people and we're losing our humanity. For Merton, if you're losing your humanity, you're losing your connection to God. You're losing life. You're losing not the church, not the Bible, not conferences, but the actual life of your life is the spiritual life of God. If we lose touch with that, we start to lose our humanity. And so it looks like our world, if we just watch movies, if we just watch the zombie movies, there's one with Brad Pitt called World War Z. And he's a doctor, he's a healer. And he goes to work for the United Nations because somehow all over the world, you can watch this on Netflix or something if you get that, or rent it out of one of those red box places. But the all of humanity becomes zombies, and they just start running and attacking everybody. Just swarms. They look like ants. It's an amazing special effects kind of film. But you get toward the film, I'm not going to give it away. But it has a kind of, they do it in a pseudo-Hollywood spiritual wisdom sense. It doesn't quite work. But they're kind of on to something that is something in us that we have lost contact with that allows us to lose our humanity and become a zombie. And so how are you going to be able to check that? And how do zombies know? Because zombies, they're trying to kill anybody who's human, anybody who's alive, anybody who has any sensibility. And so I don't want to give this away, World War Z. But something about our sensibility, and Merton has already referred to this spiritual attentiveness as our sensibility to God's life in rhythm in existence, in the universe, in this room, in each of us. This is what we're to pay attention to. And anything else distracts us from that. And it's just vital that we do. It's what makes us alive as human beings. And we're constantly in need of coming back alive because we're constantly being tempted to be deadened. And it's us that deadens ourselves by cutting ourselves off from God's life, by trying to control our soul, our mind, our heart, our life, our friends, our family, our kids, the country. If you ask any of us, put somebody in charge of healthcare. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We all know what to do, but nobody knows what to do. So we're kind of lost. Let me just lend it with there. Let's see. Let's see if anybody wants to ask anything, think anything. I'm trying to drum up something, create a little problem in the room if I can. I'll kick a table if I have to in a second. Just to kind of, let's do not get comfortable with this. We're having to break through our comfort level. This is what Merton asks. It's required to go deep. Anybody have a thought or question or argue? I'll be glad to argue as well.
You had said, and it is golden, but then I thought about it, that when speaking, if you're speaking, nothing can get in. But I think everybody has experienced golden moments when out of your mouth comes a message not for the person you're speaking with, but it's almost meant for you. And it's striking to, it's like, it's literally a highlighted moment, and you're aware that Spirit is somehow speaking, and that's how you're receiving God. And it's quite a shock when you're realizing it's coming from yourself.
Yeah, well, coming through you, I think I understand what you're saying. I mean, it makes it completely sense to me, and maybe I spoke a little errantly when I said that nothing, we don't receive anything when we're talking. It does limit things, but there's a way of talking, and this is something we can learn. This is something we can learn the more we practice contemplation, because if we're truly contemplative inside and out, from top to bottom, beginning to the end, our speaking is contemplative. It could be contemplative. And again, just in using my frame of reference, to me, then that kind of speaking would allow for a receiving of God's life. And so as you're speaking, if you're not fixated on your words or your point or the effects, but you're trying to open something up by getting these words out, you're hearing something. You may not even hear something, but you receive something. And we know this just in general for humans communicating, that someone is talking, and we've experienced this. When you're talking to somebody, you check your words when you look at their face and you look at their eyes, and if they're befuddled, if they're upset, you change your way of talking. As soon as somebody misunderstands you, you know, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't have said it like that. Let me say it like this. We're trying to always work with each other. We're kind of giving and receiving at the same time. It's so much at the same time, it's simultaneous. And that's a mysterious kind of wonder. But once you start to appreciate that, you can hear by talking. And if you talk to somebody and you can hear them when you're talking to them, that gives them that space. We were talking earlier about raising our kids. That gives them space to then say something to you, which means you can say something to me because now I can hear you. And my talking to you is not forcing and controlling something. I'm opening myself up by talking. I'm opening myself up to listening. It's almost like I'm preferring to listen if I'm understanding this, if I'm in that kind of stream, and it allows someone who's been spoken to not only to hear something, but to voice something. And people who read Merton pick this up, because he's not writing to them, but it's like he's addressing them. And they're hearing something else, not just Merton. It's not Merton's words. It's what's coming through Merton. Whether we hear it or whether we read it, or we see it, comes through and it goes out. Eckhart talked about this. Pseudo-Dionysius talked about this. This is like this rhythm of God's life just pulsating, going back and forth, in and out. Birth and rebirth and death and rebirth and on and on and on.
In your view, how does this inner upheaval that Merton talks about relate to what we refer to as the dark nights of the heart and the soul, or the senses and the soul?
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific question. I think I'm not sure how to put it. I'm kind of thinking, just at loss for words for a minute. They're both kind of unique. I'm not sure which one is more general or larger. The way Merton is talking here about the inner upheaval is kind of the ceiling we put on our soul, and a kind of a cap on things. And when we go through that, and we're underneath that, or we've transcended in some kind of way, but it's no longer pinning us down, then we're in kind of what John of the Cross talked about as a dark night, where you don't have anything to see. You have nothing to go on. As long as you have something to go on, you've got a light. Maybe it's an artificial light, and you can see where you're going and see what you're thinking and see what you're doing. But the way John of the Cross is talking about the dark night, he's not talking about, if you're not familiar with him, it's not depression. It's not, but it is this sense of a human being experiencing God and having nothing to cling to, nothing to go on. And for John of the Cross, you have to go through that darkness. I won't go too much further, but if you've read John of the Cross, you know how deep that whole idea goes. I think here for Merton, it is really kind of a more of a psychological kind of falsity that we have to blast through. That's a little bit more shallower than the Dark Knight. One of his worst books, in his opinion, was the book he wrote on John of the Cross, called Ascent of the Soul. And he tried. He just loved John of the Cross, and Ascent to Truth. That's the name of it. I'm sorry, Ascent to Truth. But he tried to write about John of the Cross instead of expressing his own life. Most of his books that are so good, Contemplation and World of Action, Thoughts and Solitude, his autobiography, New Seeds of Contemplation, which is his probably greatest book, most seminal work, all come out of him. But when he tried to write about John of the Cross, and as much as he identified with him, he kind of deadened it a little bit. Though if you love John of the Cross, you can get a lot of value out of it. But he couldn't express himself that well, and he faltered himself for what he did, kind of capsized on John. That's a terrible response to the question, but I just think he's just psychologically more tight with this individual kind of breakthrough. But I'll say one more thing about John of the Cross, though. Remember, he teaches us that when we sense, and John and Merton picked up on this, when we feel God working in us, we tend to think that's inspiration and we're feeling it, we're in the Spirit. John the Cross actually taught, this is why the dark night of the soul becomes so important, that when God works in you, when he really works in you the most, you don't feel it. You think he's gone. It's when you sense God is absent from you. That's why the dark night is so terrifying to somebody. I don't have a conception of God. I remember Mother Teresa saying similar things recently. But all these other times when we think God is working in us, and all the Lord's led me, and the Lord's told me this, that's probably more than likely us kind of interpreting and saying some things. But when God's actually growing you and nurturing you, you don't necessarily sense it at all. And so that sensitizes the soul to start to get comfortable with, I don't know what's going on, and kind of prefer that to to the confidence of the religious person who knows what's going on, and I know exactly how God works, and this is how he's worked in my life, and it's amazing. Well, that's not what John the Cross said. It's not how Merton understood him.
Oh, Teya de Shede. I don't remember if Teya came first or Merton came first.
If who came first?
Who came first?
Oh, no, no. This is Abbott Costello, right? So who's on first? What's on second? I don't know who's on third, if I remember
what?
Right. Yeah, well, what's on... now, who did you say besides Merton that was who came
Teya
first?
Teya de Chardin.
Oh,
reality.
Oh. Yeah, I think Chardin came before. Chardin was earlier. Merton did read him and thought he was quite something. But I don't remember. I don't remember his dates right now. But I do think he was. He was before that.
So Merton knew him.
I don't think he knew him personally, but
no,
he knew some of his writings. Mm-hmm. Seemed like Chardin. I don't know. I want to say he died in the 60s. Merton died in 68, but maybe it was the 50s. But I don't recall the dates. But I do know Chardin was in trouble early in the century when Merton was a kid. So so Chardin came first.
Thank you.
Who were Merton's mentors that sort of bubble up to the top in your mind?
Wow, that's a good question. The you know, he had mentors all the way through his life. Jacques Maritain, a French theologian, was very heavy as an influence on Merton. Some of his professors at Columbia, Dan Walsh and Mark Van Doren, who taught English, taught Dante. They stayed mentors to him all his life. Some of his friends he had in college he stayed in contact with, and they were kind of mentors in another kind of way, in a friendly iron sharpens iron sort of way. But then books and writings and people in history became mentors. He thought he was a 14th century man. So anybody from the 14th century, John Rusbrecht, who I'd really recommend to you. Rusbrecht talks about the living life. I just think that's a wonderful phrase. Rusbrecht. Well, I can give you the American publication version, and he's Flemish, so it's R U Y S B R O E-C-K, Rusbrecht. Some spellings have two U's at the beginning, and you see some other kangaroo spellings with a couple O's and that kind of a thing. But John's his first name, that's easy. He's a contemporary of Eckhart. So kind of from the area of Belgium. But Cloud of Unknowing, so those spiritual giants, the Desert Fathers and the Patristic Fathers, these were all mentors in the written word kind of sense. And of course, he had some spiritual guidance at the monastery as well. And there's some other people, but he so quickly became a mentor to other people. It's a tough one. But I'd say this guy, to me, was very humble because he was always open to learning from anybody. So he was prone to be and ready to be educated by anybody who could tell him something real. This is what you could easily mentor him. So when he heard Bob Dylan for the first time, he wanted to hear more Bob Dylan. He thought he could learn from Bob Dylan. Joan Baez, I'm getting ahead, that's the 60s, but Joan Baez said, Merton, we need you on the streets. The movement is going. We need your voice. But he wasn't going to leave the monastery. But he jazz music. He wanted to watch some Japanese movies toward the end. I mean, he was just open to... And that's a spirit of openness to mentoring, being guided, being taught. That's a sign of humility.
Is there a difference between feeling something and sensing something? It seems to be that those words are used interchangeably, and
yeah.
I was wondering if it would have a difference in what you were trying to convey.
Well, you know, I'm always trying to convey something, and I never know if I'm thinking it or feeling it or sensing it or saying it or I don't know the difference, but I sense and I feel a difference with both. One of the traditions in our faith is this conception of spiritual senses, that our soul has faculties. And this is where the intellect originally came from, and the will, memory, was a faculty of the soul, according to St. Augustine, St. Bernard, and others. And so the soul has faculties that then sort of get translated through our empirical lives, our sensing equipment, our feelings, our emotional stuff, and through our head. The intellect was the highest part of the soul. It was not reason. It was higher than reason. But they would talk about spiritual senses. And that kind of went out. When contemplation went out as a term that was, everybody knew what they were sort of, that was very common. About 1650 on, we start to lose contemplation. From 1650 on, we start to lose spiritual faculties. Everything becomes reason and figuring out, or through the physical senses. And we cut ourselves off spiritually. So when we're in a tough place today, trying to regather what our soul is to this life of our life. And what we're trained in our feelings and our thoughts, but we don't have that training and that spiritual sensibility. So we don't really have the terms anymore, it doesn't seem like, to where we would be clear on those kinds of distinctions. Well, what it is exactly that we sense. To me, sensing is a little more general than feeling. I can feel something, but then I can sense something that seems like a different sensation in me than a feeling. But I, for the life of me, I have no idea. There's some great research in emotions in Australia, an institute study of the history of emotions. We've studied the history of human thought. That dawned on some intellectuals to go, what about how people have felt? Have people felt differently over time? Do emotions develop in a person's life like thought develops? Well, they're studying that. And they're studying that our emotional sensibility has evolved in cultural changes, movements, and things like that. That's kind of fascinating. We're just starting to, sense that.
I read this a while ago, but it came to me this, when I was, preparing to come here. And it's from, the Seven Story Mountain, but it's just a couple lines that really touched me, and that's Mark Van Doren, the gentleman, his mentor you just spoke of, would come into a room and without any fuss would start talking about whatever was to be talked about. Most of the time, he asked questions. His questions were very good, and if you tried to answer them intelligently, you found yourself saying excellent things that you did not know you knew, and that you had not, in fact, known before. Oh. I just thought that was a wonderful thought.
Yeah, no, that is. And that's, I appreciate you pulling it out. What a beautiful quote. And it's really so much more eloquent in describing this sense in which you, kind of what we were talking about earlier about expressing, and you don't know where this is coming from. But the ground is open. I mean, there's a clearing. And the soul can come out and something gets expressed and you had no idea that was in you. You had no idea that your life was like this or had this to it. Until somebody comes in and they don't do anything, but they're open to it as well. And who knows what it is, where we feel or think or see it. But somehow when it becomes okay to sense this, you kind of open up and you feel yourself thinking and feeling and maybe even eventually doing things that you would not have dreamed of possible before. It's not a rational kind of thing. It's not an irrational kind of thing, but it's a kind of awakening of one's life. And people do this to each other. I mean, kids, their parents are the first ones that awaken them to what the heck is going on. But then they can so quickly start to curb it. Well, I'll tell you what's going on. It is, we're all Republicans in this family, or we're all Democrats and we're Unionists, and then you will be one of the Joneses and we're going to do all this. We can start to lose that openness. So when a teacher like Van Doren comes into a classroom and does not try to lay knowledge heavy on people, they can use their minds instead of chunking their minds out the window and repeating what someone else just said. How can you think that way? You can't learn anything if you're just repeating what someone else knows. You have to know yourself. And you can't know anything yourself as a spiritual person if you don't experience anything yourself. So whatever, that's that breaking out that we have to get out of to where we didn't experience. But we don't know what we're going to do. We don't know. And that puts us right back in. So we stay on the shore.
Dr. Gray, we're ready to experience lunch.
Okay.
Let's just be aware of God's presence, huh? God is very much present to us. And Lord, we thank you for all of your gifts. We thank you for the gifts we're about to receive. The ones we have received are through Gray. We ask you to be open to your presence at all time. And we ask you to grow in gratitude and in love. We call down your blessing upon us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.